Good evening, everyone. This is John Galt speaking, and welcome to the Macroedge Radio Edition 1. Let's get the legal and disclaimer stuff out of the way first. Welcome to Macroedge Radio. Please note the content aired on this program is intended strictly for entertainment and educational purposes only, and does not, I repeat, does not constitute financial, legal, or professional advice. The opinions, discussions, and views expressed are by our contributors, guests, and associated Macroedge staff are their own and do not necessarily represent the official stance, strategy, or opinions of the Macroedge organization or any of its affiliates. While we strive to provide accurate and up-to-date information, Macroedge Radio makes no representations or warranties of any kind, expressed or implied, about the completeness, accuracy, reliability, suitability, or availability of the content of this show. Any reliance you place on such information is strictly at your own risk. We do not endorse or assume responsibility for the accuracy or reliability of any information offered by third-party websites linked through the show or any website or feature linked in any banner or other advertising. We will not be a party to or in any way responsible for monitoring any transaction between you and third-party providers of products or services. All audio content of Macroedge Radio is the intellectual property of the Macroedge organization, and any use, reproduction, or redistribution of this content without the express written consent of the Macroedge organization is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved. Take it over, sir. And don't know if you can hear me. Get Macroedge Ozone now and experience how we're changing the way enterprises, business leaders, and individuals interact with and view critical economic data at macroedge.sub. So tonight we're going to go over a lot of issues, primarily four major subjects. The first one, though, is the labor, unemployment, and gig job market. It has absolutely imploded. I turn this over to our Macroedge host. Please take over, Don.
All right, guys, so we're going to go over four different subjects today. Participation is encouraged. We would like to see some audience participation. We're going to go over labor, unemployment, gig, and job market. We're going to go over real estate and CRE. We're going to go over Fed policy, and we're going to go over markets. So the first thing we're going to go over is labor, unemployment, gig, and job market. So what we've been seeing is that in March, the labor market continued to cool more broadly, and this was a core reason for the Powell's dovish pivot, especially on a cool down of the rate and QT on Powell's front. The Fed rarely gets it right on the timing of rate cuts, and with the current 10-year, 3-month spread at over minus 100 basis points, which is now tied for the longest inversion on record, it's likely that they've made another policy mistake. So the final estimate that we have for the Macroedge job cuts tracker for March is 73,477, which is a slight decline of last month at 78,272. And the peak that we've seen for this year in January of 103,470 job cuts. What we have seen this month is a pickup in the layoff breadth. So we've seen more cuts outside of just tech, but with the absence of tech earnings, we may see that pick up again in April and May.
So with that pickup in April and May 6, do you foresee a problem
regarding the economic projections presented by the Federal Reserve and, of course, our friends on the various bubble visions broadcasting every week, every day, nonstop pushing their product.
Absolutely. Every month, pretty much so far, we've seen, for the last year, we've seen overstated payrolls, and they've gone back to revise those numbers drastically lower. The numbers that have came in as, in many cases, large beats on payrolls have turned out to be substantial misses in many cases. They've overstated the payrolls over the last year by at least 800,000 jobs, and now we have unemployment, as of the last reading, a surprise uptick up to 3.9%, and that is a trend that I think will continue in that direction for sure.
What do you make of the recent information from the Philadelphia Fed overstating the unemployment numbers and the new jobs numbers in creation? Because it would appear that this revisions of revisions for prior revisions is an ongoing theme, not just the BLS, but from all of our government, and especially the Federal Reserve recently.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that that's a trend that we will see continue to happen. I'm not sure where they're getting these numbers from. They looked very attractive when they first come out, and then, you know, they revise them lower the next month, and they release them, conveniently it seems, with the new payroll numbers that are also good for the next month, and then they kind of just slide it in there that the last month's was directly the opposite of what they had projected and hoped for. We also have a very drastic uptick in gig employment. Uber and Lyft are showing some of their highest amounts of employment and new employment coming on, which makes sense because if you get laid off, I mean, are you going to go for unemployment or – which doesn't pay very much, or are you going to go to do some kind of gig work like driving for Uber? Now, does a job like driving for Uber constitute the same kind of employment that a full-time job would? I don't think so.
You're live, Mr. Bubbles. Okay, well, this is live radio, folks, so buckle up and prepare. We're going to work through this and get through this at a rapid pace. Six, got a question for you on another part that you, of the thing that you brought up, the disparity between the labor market activity index. Oh, I think I got Mr. Sun Bubbles on. Go ahead, please. He just disconnected. We have this problem with live radio. It is what it is. Six, you were talking also between the Fed Manufacturing Employment Index and the KC Labor Market Activity Index. There appears to be a sudden and sharp downturn at the end of 2023. What do you make of the data from the regional feds versus national projections coming from D.C.?
So what we see from the Kansas City Fed Labor Market Index is a pretty drastic downturn of labor market index activity starting around the peak of the equity markets, and that has since trended down since the equity markets peaked. While the equity markets have gone higher, the Kansas City Fed Labor Market Activity Index has trended lower. Every time it has trended lower, it has foreshadowed a recession, and it trended down from 1.5 down into negative territory from the peak of the tech bubble in 2000 down to its maximum drawdown there in about 2003. Then it trended back higher into positive territory going into 08, and it started taking a spill in late 2007. And it troughed around negative 2.5 in about 2010, then proceeded higher on a trend basis leading into 2020, where it took another major dip down to about the negative 2.5 level. Right now, we are trending down from a peak of about 1.5 to we're about 0.5 right now, and it's just trending lower right now. And I don't see much that would make that change course with the Fed at peak policy rate. I think that trend is going to continue.
Excellent. One of our more proficient macro edge posters, please jump in here now with your opinion on this, because what we're seeing here is a conflict between the reality that we see on the local level in various parts of the country versus the data that's being projected on the various media and Fed speakers. Please add your two cents.
Well, you've got that part. I was going to go back and talk also about the unemployment and the information that's constantly being put out and then revised. And basically that happens on both sides of the aisle. Like the Republicans will do it. The Democrats will do it. They're just expected to do it when they get into office. And what's happened over, as I've been on national and state boards over years, and what's happened is they're going further and further with the information each time. So it's like they're expected to kind of fudge the data a little bit, and everybody expects that, but it's just each time it's getting worse and worse and getting pushed back and forth and back and forth. And so now you're sitting, yeah, they had to revise their information by 800,000 jobs that basically don't exist, but then that'll turn around and make, you know, cutting the interest rates that much easier when you look at it and you say, well, our labor market is a lot weaker than we originally thought.
What does everyone think about the problems heading out west as opposed to a normal Rust Belt southeast wave heading west? It appears this time we have a convergence of the Rust Belt and the far west creating the unemployment issues, and the data seems to reflect that. Anybody who wishes to jump in, please go right ahead.
Well, they were the first to lay off, and it seems like the lag has been a lot of the layoffs were in tech. They came from California. They came from the West. And then also you've got also in Texas in the Rust Belt, like you said, they seem to be the first to lay off. And what happened with that is the data seems to be lagging a lot more than we think, not just on the unemployment, but the unemployment data as well, or the people like Six was talking about. They might just not be able to get unemployment, and they're having to go out and work the gig jobs and do the gig economy because they can't live off $200 or $300 a week in unemployment. And that's the biggest thing with the unemployment numbers. They haven't gone up mainly because they never kept up with inflation. You cannot live off $300 or $400 a week in this country. So why would you go file unemployment?
Well, that brings up the gig economy, as it's called. California has basically undergone a revision of the regulatory structure, declaring gig jobs actual employment subject to unionization and potentially other nefarious ideas such as minimum wage, benefits, etc. Is their idea of destroying the concept of the private contractor actually going to drive unemployment higher as people are forced back into the workforce, the measured workforce, I should say, and thus no longer able to make an independent living as a contractor? Please jump in, anyone. I saw the impact directly in the transportation industry. We've already had three cartage companies fail in Southern California, which serve the port of Long Beach and Los Angeles. And what has occurred is basically you've taken the independent contractor status and turned it into a professional company, a professional employment option, and it has made a nightmare out of what is going on for the people who wish to sit there and work independently with flexible hours and their own ability to set their hours, set their own benefit schedule, set their own savings, and file taxes on their own. Joseph Middleton, would you like to add to this, please?
Yeah, so I think one of the differences that we're seeing this cycle, especially when you're talking about the gig economy and unemployment, is, yeah, you're faced with many of the people who were, say, laid off or even decided to leave their current careers or current professions to pursue something else or are choosing the gig economy because it's so accessible, right? We have seen, and Powell has talked specifically about services being a key for their stickier inflation and the strength in the services sector and stuff like that. Fast forward a little bit after COVID, you have all of these things popping up. You have Uber Eats, Instacart, all of this stuff. There is plenty of availability for people to pick up these positions. And not only are they picking up one, they could very well be picking up two to make ends meet. Like you say, unemployment historically is not there to create a living wage, right? So it was only meant to give I think for the state of Michigan and my state, it's right around half or half of a full paycheck every 2 weeks. So when people are faced with either trying to go through the hassle of unemployment or I'll pick up a job at DoorDash or something just to get by, you're starting to see people become better at these positions, and they're starting to find ways to become more successful at them. So they'll pick up more and they'll pick up more. And that's great and all, right? You know, you have people who are going out and maybe they like being an independent contractor. Ever since COVID, the hybrid work and independent working or being able to dictate your own schedules has been really center, because COVID just allowed everyone to stay home all the time. You know, it forced everyone into staying home. But I think a lot of people started to realize that they can make a good living on these types of jobs. The big issue that I see, especially when it concerns unemployment, is jobs like that are very susceptible to certain shocks. And the services like we see over here in the Midwest, I've been around my state, really mainly Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois a couple of different times in the past. And positions like that aren't what you're going out, you're filling up grocery baskets for other people, you're dropping off at their house and everything's fine and dandy. There's two main classifications that I've seen with positions like this. There's those who are starting to become over-dependent on them, and I think that holds a greater majority of the workforce currently. I have run across plenty of people who are maybe closer to like their 40s, early 50s, maybe they just wanted to get out of the office and do something different. And they found success in these gig positions, and that's great. But these people aren't set up the same as who are becoming more dependent on them. And that's where the susceptibility to shocks come in, right? We've seen headlines in the past about Uber fighting to unionize, about Instacart getting funding from the federal government. I think the Biden administration, it was late last year, December, I want to say early January this year, wants to subsidize healthier foods for families. You know, so they're subsidizing these companies to keep them active, and their workforces are growing. You know, that's great, but we're still sitting in a high inflationary environment. And sooner or later, people are going to have to wonder, or people are going to have to reconcile, do they want to pay for these services still? Or are they just going to go back to going to the grocery store themselves, right? Most times, people are going to cut these things out after they figure out, well, I don't really like the driver that I got last time, or they're going to run into an issue with the service, they're going to cut the service, and they're going to save that money. What happens is when you have an overabundance of people working for these services, you either don't have much competition anymore, so wages start to suffer. You know, people don't make as much money. We've seen in Colorado, there was that story a few weeks back about an Uber driver who used to make good money doing it, right? Well, now that there's Uber drivers everywhere, that workforce is oversaturated and it's pushing people back out. So like you brought up, you know, is it going to force people back into the measured employment? Or are people going to fall back into going to different services? And we're just going to see this mixture, this churn of people going from service gig work to service gig work to service gig work until it just flat out doesn't work anymore. I think the shock would come in that I'm kind of foreseeing is if we start to see demand pull back, or if you start to see certain litigations over civil liabilities for some of these jobs, and it forces people out of the workforce, we're going to see that uptick in unemployment that you're talking about.
Joseph, I'm going to ask a question because I have to view this from a Florida perspective. My travels outside of this region have been limited lately, so please understand if this is not a question related to the direct politics of your region, but to the actual economic reality. Has the decline in the so-called government-sponsored EV boom started to filter down not just through the car industry, but to the related industries that support the car industry in your region?
I think so, especially as it pertains to EVs. So in the state of Michigan, we do see a lot of EVs around here. We don't see a lot, as you would say, in California or Florida. Some of the southern states, Texas, I understand there's probably a little bit more EV action down there. But up here, we don't really see that. And I think a lot of that is people just don't trust it. you know, the Blazer EVs, I'm partial to Chevrolet. I come from a Chevrolet family. I'm not a big fan of the Ford F-150 Lightning, for instance. And that's, you know, I've posted about it a couple of times, and I know we've spoken about it a couple of times in the group chats. The EV situation is not playing out the way that the government had wanted, right? So when Ford jammed this this new F-150 Lightning battery factory down the throats of the residents of the village of Marshall here in Michigan, they had no idea. You know, now, fast forward, not even, just barely over a year, construction's already been halted once. Production and output has already been cut. Positions that were, it was supposed to bring in 2,500 jobs, now it's looking to add just about, I think it was about 1,200. Yeah, 1,200, because they were taking 700-800 away. So it's not evolving the way that they wanted it to. Plus, I can understand that areas, like you guys don't get a lot of cold weather down there. I've heard a couple stories from people, even with Teslas, that in the wintertime, they're just not as reliable as people are comfortable with. You know, in Michigan, we've seen a lot of mild winters lately, especially this winter. There was very few days where we got a ton of snow. We're at a record low amount of snow, I believe, for this year. But even then, we still get hammered. You know, we'll still get a snowstorm where we get 7, 8, 9 inches overnight. And the EVs, the trust in them just isn't there.
Astonishingly enough, it's not here either of your Lightning that you speak of. So finally, keep in mind, in this area, we have a lot of people that tow boats or also are involved in construction. Just to give you some theory, to travel from my county, which is Sarasota County, to St. Petersburg or Clearwater, is about 60 miles one way. If you're towing 5,000 pounds, a Ford dealer told me this on the QT, that if you towed 5,000 pounds behind your truck, which is not unusual in the construction industry, you would have to recharge your vehicle when you reached your destination. That's the absurdity of trying to force a commercial application for electric vehicles. And in fact, some of the fleets I've talked to, including a rather large rental corporation, basically keeps their EV vans and trucks in the back of their lot, hoping that no one asked for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be a bigger problem commercial anywhere you go. You know, you can throw out the Tesla semis, this, that, and the other thing. You know, I saw a photo of a Tesla semi pulling a Cheetos trailer, and it was like, well, from my personal perspective, every time you open a bag of chips, it's half air anyways, right? So what's the weight on that trailer versus how many hours is that truck going to be able to be on the road? When you're looking at freight and stuff like that, a lot of times you're looking at how far can my drivers go. There was a big argument for the longest time of drivers when the Qualcomms first got put in their semis. They were taking the chips out of the back of them. There was and I don't know what exactly the chip was, because this is just, I have an uncle in the freight industry also. They would take the chips out so the GPS wouldn't work, because they wanted to put in more hours, right? So they measure efficiency on a different scale. It's not just about if they're green or something like that. It's how far can this truck get versus how much downtime does it need? You know, previously it was just measuring diesel fuel, idle hours, stuff like that. There was always labor fights in the going back to the early 2000s about drivers who didn't want to be handicapped by how many hours they could drive. Clearly, we need regulations like that. But when you change over to EVs, it completely changes the ball field, right? You're not just a truck driver pulling a load over the road from Michigan, let's say, down to Florida. You already mapped out where's your truck stops. You know, how far can I get? You can't do that with the EVs yet. Until they can get a sustainable infrastructure for recharging and stuff like that, and that's, you know, just speaking on freight, you're not going to see a widespread acceptance of it, because people just don't trust it. The worst thing you could ever be as a truck driver on the side of the road with a dead battery, you can't find a charger, right? And there's been attempts in the past to set up this EV infrastructure. GM was working with pilot stations to create a coast-to-coast network of charging stations, and that's fine. But when you're looking at all this downtime, even if you're just traveling, you're taking the family out, like you say, if you're towing stuff, if it's a construction site, you get to your site and you got to recharge just to get back to the shop at the end of the day. That is not reasonable for a commercial application at this point.
And with that being said, Mr. Sunbubbles wants to bring into the conversation round trip back to where we started with the gig economy. And that is an issue which is being impacted by the sudden decline in jobs and expansion of companies. With the number of layoffs, it really does sit there and present a challenge. Mr. Bubbles, if you're there, please take it away. Bring us into that, because it all ties full circle into the growing unemployment and layoffs that are occurring right now in our society.
Yeah, I think, can everybody hear me? I think you can. I want to bring up a point, and this is not a phenomenon that's local to my area here in Utah, particularly for the gig workers. 8 out of 10, food delivery service in particular, the person delivering the food will not match even the gender or ethnicity of the person here. So what will happen, we haven't talked about the surge in gig workers. A lot of them are illegal immigrants operating under their relatives who are legal immigrants. Example, I have a neighbor who his illegal cousins run DoorDash, Uber Eats, and whatever all the other food services are. According to that, he is working, 200 hours a week delivering all these services, and they're just operating under his name and then taking a percentage of the take. So, and then this particular has gotten bad that college students in Utah are operating under. I had a 19-year-old blonde-haired girl driver who is actually a Guatemalan deliver me a sandwich today. So that's one particular aspect of the earnings dropping down and Uber drivers and everybody else not being able to make it, the surge in workers. People are running this kind of fraud/hustle.
Well, being far away from that portion of the nation, where in Florida you would get hammered pretty hard by the state for violating those regulations, how are these people going to file a 1099 for 200 hours and abide by the work rules of the individual states out west? I'm curious.
I mean, I don't know. This is something that I've seen in the last 3 months predominantly just take off like crazy. So I don't know if people are seeing it or even looking for it in their market. I mean, how often do you actually look at the face of a food delivery driver? They can really get away with it just dropping at the front porch and sending the picture anyway.
So I've seen stuff like this. I personally know people that have gone from, they'll work for Uber and Lyft. I've seen people who have, I know people personally who have gone from, doing 12 hours for Uber, and then they'll immediately log on to Lyft and then run another 12 hours and do 24 hours straight, because they'll limit you after a certain amount of hours on one platform, and they'll just switch to another platform on food delivery service. Maybe they'll switch from Uber Eats to DoorDash after a certain amount of hours, but there's ways to do it if they want to do it, and that's how they're probably doing it. And to wrap up employment, what I wanted to touch on last to show where we really are in the employment cycle is the SAM rule. So if you don't know what the SAM rule is, it triggers when the unemployment rate's 3-month average climbs 50 basis points above a 12-month low. And when that happens, technically the recession has arrived according to that metric. So the SAM rule right now has not triggered for the U.S. as a whole, but it has flashed the trigger symbol in 20 states as of 2 days ago, and looks like it's heading higher nationally. So that's a good indicator of where we are in the employment cycle. It looks like we're about to hit a turning point here in the economy based on that metric. So I'll wrap it up with that for a second.
That sounds good, guys. And by the way, the SAM rule, she, I think, has already blocked me because I challenged her stupid rule, because she seems to have it as a rule of convenience rather than actual strict economic theory. Mr. Awesome is going to tie this in, because with the declining changes in unemployment, with the layoffs comes another cost, and that is commercial real estate, residential real estate, etc. We have a lot of great people at MacroEdge.net who write about this subject. You can check out the papers on Friday nights via the Red Eye, special occasions during the week, and, of course, Sunday with the regular edition. Mr. Austin, let's ask the question and get right to it. How bad has this snowball developed in the past 3 months that we've discussed online, but now we can talk about it on the radio?
Well, it's a great question, and good evening, Macro After Dark. My name is Mr. Awesome, but you can call me Mr. Awesome. I'm glad to be here with everybody tonight, and for those of you that are not familiar with me or my writing for Macro Edge, or occasionally for Melody Wright, who's been so kind as to allow me the occasion to write for her, I'm a contractor and a consultant in both the real estate and construction industries. I work a lot in pre-development, financial modeling, as well as project management, including for some national builders. So that's a little bit about my background and why I track this space the way that I do. I want to add some charts here. So if everybody wants to turn their attention to the comments. Give me 1 second here, John.
That's no problem. I'm good at killing dead air. That was my profession. Oh, that was when I was a management consultant firing people. Never mind. Go right ahead, Mr. Awesome.
I bet you're good at that. So I'm adding a chart right now that's both residential and it's residential, but it's existing and new home sales. And the reason why I want to point this out is because there's a lot of talk going around. Is the real estate market healthy? Is the real estate market not healthy? And if we were to actually look at the long-term trends, I think it's pretty easy to see where that's going. So let's see if that's uploaded so everybody can take a peek. So as you can see, going back through May of 2020 up to today, the trend is downward for both new family houses sold as well as existing homes sold. So everybody, I think, is aware that sales have been dropping, but we've got an even more significant trend going the opposite direction if we're looking at the inventories. Now, this next chart that I'm posting is new home inventories and existing home inventories. And the chart's basically going the exact opposite direction. So what we've got going is a divergence in the number of sales and the inventory of real estate available in the residential market. I point this out because on a longer term trend, there are cycles in real estate like there is everything business-wise. And there are patterns that develop. And when these patterns start emerging, it's pretty clear indication that it's not good for the economy overall. Obviously, there is always, the hope for a soft landing. I think we had two real soft landings, but, the way that this is diverging, I'm going to post the next chart here that shows, again, the divergence in at least new home sales versus the homes that are for sale. And I think you can see quite a divergence. John, you want to check and see if that's available online? If it's posted in the comments?
It is.
I'm sort of, thanks guys, because I'm sort of stuck watching the audio and trying to manage the speaker invite, so bear with me here. I'm looking at totally different screens than you guys.
Yeah, we're seeing it under your response to the comment thread.
Yep. Okay, awesome. This last chart, what we're looking at is the, again, new houses for sale versus the new houses that are being sold. And as you can see, dating through the start of, end of recessions to the next recession, there are some pretty clear patterns. And you can even see that 95, 96, the red line, which is the new houses for sale, kind of typical of what would happen pre-recession, indication of a soft landing there. And then again, in 1984, in 1985, you can see the same thing happening there. If you're looking at where we're at today, it's quite an enormous divergence.
With that being said, with that divergence, what are we looking at as far as what's occurring and the impact on real estate as a whole? Because if you start tying all of this in together, there's a problem coming up, and I don't know how this is going to turn out.
Sure. Well, this is something that I know it's very delicate for a lot of people, because while we do have inflation increasing in certain areas, we also have what's going on in real estate, which is negative pricing pressure, which is new homes and their sales prices have been contracting considerably. And I'll post a chart in the comments here, and you might have seen this get shared, but this next one is the single-family home price. A brand-new home has dropped 20% since its pricing peak in October of 2022. So it's a pretty steady decline. We're well into contraction in pricing territory there. And as you can see, it's not based solely on, you know, building smaller homes. This is just an outright price contraction, which is also something that we have seen in cycles going back throughout the years, all the way back, you know, into the 1970 recession, into 73, 1980, 1981, so on and so forth.
Is it reflective of the fact that single family homes are now becoming unaffordable for the lower middle and lower class in our society without the, with a glaring lack of starter homes?
Say that one more time, John.
Sorry about that, Mr. A. Is this not also reflective of the fact that we're seeing a decline in what's called the old starter home, the sub $225,000, 1,200 square foot, 2-2-2-1 homes that were the original so-called starters for the entry-level buyer? Is this decline in affordability reflective of the builders refusing to provide that to the public as a whole?
Well, there's some interesting things that have gone on across the country, and I think everybody's probably shared and made light of some of the small houses being built by Lennar in Texas, you know, 600, 700 square foot homes. But the reality is there isn't much of a market for that, and there have been several builders that have made the attempts, but they have literally gone unsold. And now at the time where we've past peak cycle in pricing, they're not looking at it in the terms of how do you build a small starter home, and even with the prices where they are, it's not going to go back. Well, it's not at the 250 level yet. There's the chance that we get there, but it's so far there's been no real market demand wanting the homes that will actually cost less versus having a three bedroom or four bedroom home.
So I just added a chart onto the bottom of your chart, Mr. Awesome, about median household price to median income. Right now, the median household price is higher than it was in the housing bubble to the median income, and higher than it's been since this data set goes back to at least the 1950s, and it's higher than it's been ever since then. How does that factor into your affordability ideas here? What do you think happens next?
Well, I think that's one of the things that is creating the issue that we have in having negative pricing power in the home building industry. The reality is that with the exception of between 15 and 30% of the population, people don't have the ability to purchase a home outright with cash. So homes get financed. Well, when we have cycle peaks in pricing, we also have the decline in pricing because people are basically priced out, whether it's from the rate cycle increases or both the rate increases in the 30-year mortgage, in the federal fund rates, and the price increases. Prices wind up having to come down or everything grinds to a halt. And we're actually seeing that. We're seeing a decline, again, since 2022 in the number of homes that are being built. So we're building less. We're selling less, and the prices are coming down, and it's actually coming down faster than it has in any of the previous contraction cycles in the past. And we're not in recession yet, at least it hasn't been declared. So how far this goes is really, you know, it's concerning in the industry because there could be a really long runway of price declines.
Well, this brings us full circle back to commercial real estate. With the slacking of demand in industrial production, which appears to be on the horizon for the government-promoted industries, for those industries that are not catering to consumers, and also with a potential slowdown in building, what is happening where we're seeing a ton of CRE absolutely getting devastated with markdowns of 50, 60, 70, even more percent on the market day to day. Six, Mr. A, anybody please jump in, because this is going to impact the regional banks. Yet there seems to be this mindset that this is not going to impact the regional banks because Jay Powell said so. Please, someone, take that away.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're seeing – I feel like we're seeing at least one a day of a $100 million plus CRE property that's getting marked down and sold for pennies on the dollar, 50% discount, sometimes more. And you have the regional banks, which have – many of them have over 100%, sometimes 200, 300% plus of their CET1 capital in commercial real estate exposure. And if you have more than 200% of your commercial real estate exposure, of your CET1 capital in commercial real estate, and then they take a 50% markdown, you're in some muddy waters there.
So
no doubt.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Ray.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
Well, my question is this: we saw the downgrades for several regional banks in the middle of the last week. Granted, it's a holiday week; it's a great time to mark. To issue downgrades, why haven't we seen that impact reflected on their bottom line yet? I'm waiting to hear this, because when you're taking those kind of downgrades and markdowns on properties that they are losing $20, $30, $50, $200 million on, at some point it hits your profitability, especially with the BTFP gone.
Well, I mean, if those properties are still able to, through however they are, able to just continue to make their debt payments, it's not an issue yet. If their loan isn't coming up for refinancing, it's not an issue yet, but that doesn't mean that it's looming. And with inflation running hot right now and the Fed not in any rush to cut, depending on how you look at it, I mean, Powell today said that we can take our time, but we'll see what he does. They had 7 cuts planned for the beginning of the year. Now it's marked down to 3, but, you know, we'll see. But basically with rates staying elevated like this, they're just cooking that frog and boiling it.
Well, I think we're beginning to see the show up in banks, in that they're actually starting to take keys back and that they're actually starting to have trouble. But I think it's just getting started. I just added a couple of charts as well. It's the U.S. industrial vacancy rate and the national multifamily vacancy rate, and it's elevating and quite rapidly. And I think the faster that these elevate, obviously the more pressure it's going to put on both the multifamily and the industrial sector to compound the issue going on in office. And this is really it's a cyclical problem with real estate and part of, you know, the peak unwinding from where we were. So I think, like, the lag takes a while, but eventually it shows up and it's beginning to increase its pace.
So how does everyone feel about the impact of Amazon and other logistics companies beginning to dump office and warehousing space onto the market at this point in time? Because that is a black swan event, as the realtors and developers never thought that Amazon would restructure their expansive network of distribution at any point, and thus built ahead in some cases, as we've seen all throughout Florida and the far west.
I mean, it just seems like with COVID that commercial real estate hit kind of a perfect storm. You got the work from home coming in at the same time as during COVID, when rates were essentially zero. You have all of these properties getting bid up to ridiculously low cap rates. And then you have work from home coming in on top of that, which is trying to cement itself as a structural force in the economy, which now, you know, you have everybody trying to get people back to work. But it's an issue. It's a definite issue. And I think that the prices are just going to have to come down. The cap rates are going to have to come up. The industry as a whole just needs to be repriced, because the prices don't work for how they bid it up to when rates were zero.
That's ultimately the reality of it, and it's facing real estate across the country in every sector. Speculation, you know, really got heavy in 2020, 2021, first part of 2022. I think there was some speculation going into it before that, but ultimately there was the expectation that rents were always going to go up and that costs don't go up with the property. And that's why we've had these, you know, issues with real estate in the past and why everybody wonders, you know, is it happening again? It always happens. It's really a cyclical thing. It's not a new phenomenon. We're just witnessing it unwind, and it always seems to take longer than it should, right? I mean,
you fall apart, takes a while.
Yeah, you know, I think one thing you can add to that too is that you do have this sort of, I don't want to call it a phenomenon because, like you say, it's a cyclical matter with commercial real estate in general. But when you see the exodus for the office space, and you see what's going on with these massive, you know, 200,000-300,000 square feet buildings, what's the long-term goal here? You know, you can sit and say that, you know, we're going to fill these buildings all you want, but after work from home and hybrid work has gained such acceptance, and workers have pushed back on return to the office policies in such a manner, that what's going to turn these buildings around, right? They like you say, got bid up per square foot in hot sectors. A lot of these sectors, or a lot of these states, look at New York, a lot of their retail space has decided to close due to crime, due to any number of things. So when you have these larger buildings that are preconditioned for a certain thing like office space, and then you have a phenomenon where, you have the hybrid work going off, you have people turning back towards the gig work because they want to live by their own terms, they want to work on their own terms, what's going to be the turning point for these buildings to get their valuations back up? Because one of the things that I've been trying to pay more attention to is their debt to service cover ratio, a lot of the multifamilies are in trouble with that. You're seeing like a 50%, a 40%. Every now and again, you get a 60 or 70% with 80, 90% occupancy. And something's going to have to give there, right? When you look at office space versus warehousing, I know there's been a lot of debate over the last 6 months and a lot of warehousing that's going to be coming online this year. Now, some of that is going to be taken care of because we're doing the U.S. has begun their nearshoring with Mexico. So the southern states, eastern seaboard areas, granted, you got the issue with Baltimore now. They've got a lot of warehousing projects that were already pre-planned, that were already slated to start construction this year. So you're going to see all that added inventory continue to come online. And projects are already starting to get pushed. So all of these vacant spaces, I think the bigger question or the bigger concern is, what's going to happen in the future, right? These buildings are what? They're just going to sit empty?
Do you have an honest answer on that?
Well, I mean, yes, I do. I would love your honest answer on it. I'd like to think that there's going to be some type of turnaround with them. But if there's anything that I've learned, it's that you're going to get a .gov official who's going to go, hey, look, we got a housing affordability problem. We got a bunch of office space that's sitting empty, that's losing valuation, and these loans are suffering, and the loan holders can't cover it. What's it going to take for the government to subsidize a program for these houses for, they call them newcomers, or low income? You know, that's going to end up dumping a ton more Fed dollars into buildings that weren't meant to be housing. And that's going to be their easiest bet, but also the more expensive and the most risky.
Well, I think the reality is it's going to be like it has after every recession. It's not going to be an overnight thing. And there's going to be vacancies, and it takes time to absorb space, whether it's commercial or residential. And again, that's been part of the cycle, the downsides. There's no such thing as, you know, like a government program that's just going to magically fix it. Interestingly enough, you know, just made the news today, Biden has put some rent controls into place, but that's for the low-income housing tax credit program. It's already a rent-controlled affordable housing program, but putting the caps on there isn't going to, I don't think it's going to have the same effect that it's intended to. it's effect, you know, it's not really a subsidy in traditional sense of taking, you know, government funds and putting it into a program. Investors buy the tax credits by investing into affordable housing, and then they get to spread those tax credits out over the life of, you know, certain terms. And there's different 4%, 9% credits for that on LIHTC. So it's just going to disinterest people in investing further in the space. So I don't think that's going to help. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if there's not enough demand or the money doesn't work, they just sit, right? Office space sits. If it can't be converted, if there's no interest in rental, there's no interest in industrial, there's really nothing that you can do with it. You sit there and it either goes back to the city on taxes, or somebody, you know, pays out of pocket for mothballing it.
Yeah, and that's something that we've seen. You know, you like to think about Detroit as the biggest downfall, right? Especially after the auto industry in 2008 and 2007. You know, all these massive buildings in Detroit, right, that are still to this day sitting vacant. You know, how's it going to look for other states, LA, California, but New York, California, Texas, Florida, Georgia, all these places that are going to have these giant skyscrapers just sitting empty? Those are just going to be more ideation of Detroit sitting around. So what would becomes, what would it reinstill that faith that an investor is going to have, that they're going to move into this area? You know, I just can't see it playing out well.
Usually it involves some local tax subsidy, and it happened before. You know, in the 70s, New York and San Francisco both went through exactly that trouble. In fact, during the pre-1980 election, both Carter and Reagan campaigned in front of empty buildings in New York. It's just a cyclical thing. You know, obviously New York came back, San Francisco came back. They're probably positioned to come back again. You know, they're going to go through whatever length of time they have to suffer. But we're talking about New York City and San Francisco. Never say never, but I mean, I wouldn't want to be the one that said, hey, no one's ever going to New York or San Fran again.
Well, I'll be the one to say that, because if you look at the billions of dollars that have shifted out of those communities to Florida and Texas, it's going to have a long-term impact. And I think we are beginning to witness a generational shift in wealth, migration, and population growth. I mean, how many people do you hear say, I want to move to Michigan and establish a company? Not too many. That's why I would like to bring in other speakers, and I'm going to start. Ozark, you and I have been having ongoing discussions. I'm going to bring Jason in here a minute too, about the macro situation. I'm going to offer my two cents on this, because all of this deflation, which appears to be occurring in commercial real estate and starting to seep into residential, is contra to the commodity inflation we're witnessing and the absurdity of the market. Right now, the CRB index is at levels we haven't seen since the great financial crisis and accelerating. The Buffett indicator is 1.9 standard deviations above normal. We're way, and if you take out government spending from GDP calculations, it's probably closer to 2.4 times normal. That's the problem. Everyone looks at GDP as a gross situation. They don't take the net of government investment out, which provides very little benefit to the economy when making that calculation. Please give us your two cents on this, because we've had ongoing discussions in our own private chat rooms about this. It's time to broaden this discussion out.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the things that's interesting, I saw, I don't remember who tweeted it today, but there was a comment that 51 of the 52 countries that have hit 130% debt to GDP have defaulted. Well, if you subtract out, I would really call into question what the GDP figure is if you truly subtract out what that government impact is, especially at this point with the deficit where it is. I think most recently February was printing 53 cents on the dollar of federal spending. And at this point, the tax rate, and this could be February partial tax season as well, but at this point, Social Security tax is actually the number one source of government revenue, which I found to be surprising, for one. But it was also just, I think, when you start to think about the numbers here, at some point the math is just a terminal tailspin, and I don't know how you pull out of it. I also do want to keep us moving along here, but I will say that as someone who moved from the north to the south, there's a reason why people don't move back to the north, and I can't say enough good things about living below the Mason-Dixon line. Thank you.
Well, and it's an ongoing problem. We're seeing a generational transition, and I don't think people understand the consequences of this transition when you have population move. The last time we saw this type of transition was after the Civil War and also during the Industrial Revolution. It's something unique to our society because we all said this is going to be a high-tech, high-service economy. But when you start looking at the charts, you start looking at what's occurring, if you take 5 seconds to think about it, this is not your normal economic cycle. We've interrupted the business cycle without the necessary corrections that should have finished with the GFC and allowed a bubble to grow even larger than normal.
Oh, absolutely, man. I think that as far as the generational shifts go, it's interesting if you look at which states are having the net exodus, is that it tends to be concentrations of the country that have a high percentage of boomers in housing stock constructed kind of in that initial big build up with the initial ring road suburban interstate highway system. It's interesting that it doesn't, on top of the fact that the cost of living and taxes are lower, the government services are better, and once you live there's more broad concealed carry, of course. Once you live in a society that's civilized and doesn't have potholes everywhere, and you don't have to deal with snow, you're never going to move back. You know, I graduated from high school in the mid 2000s, and I would say that about 25% of my graduating class, being from New England, has moved out of New England and has moved south, especially to Florida. Southwest Florida has been a big destination for, and Orlando as well have been big destinations for over there and see six people that I've graduated from high school with. So it's certainly interesting to see, and if you want to talk to, it's the same thing. You know, New England was getting crazy. Just didn't like the direction things were going. The cost of living was too high. Then you live somewhere where everything works and you're like, why the hell would I ever go back to that place?
Precisely. And you start looking at the data that's being presented at the macro scale, starting with the stock market, which I just talked about with the GDP indicator from the Buffett indicator from versus GDP. You also have the top 10% of stocks, and we'll put this chart up through the Macro Edge feed, of stocks by size versus the entire market. We haven't seen this ratio since 1929. And no, I'm not comparing right now to 1929. It's just a historical look, which is my specialty. You add in the data that was dumped this morning claiming that PCE dropped to 0.3% month over month. You look at the H8 data, which also dropped this afternoon. Credit cards, they're back to pre-Christmas levels, but we're still elevated, far above and beyond historical averages. And then you look at the C&I loan structure. We're basically flat going on 2 years, but real estate loans in a dollar value sense are at all-time highs. Something is going to break, and you can't have moderate inflation. You can't get a little bit pregnant, and you can't have moderate inflation. You either have to hyperinflate out of this or allow a major disinflation, deflationary event to correct the price structure. Anybody wish to jump in on that?
Yeah, so I just posted some charts here. The first charts I posted are from JP Morgan Asset Management. So the concentration risk is something that we hear every day. If you follow the markets, you will see every day they're talking about the Magnificent Seven. And right now we have the top 10 stocks are making up 33.6% of the market cap of the S&P 500 right now. That is bigger than leading up to 08, which was about 24%. It was bigger even than the tech bubble, which peaked at about 27%. Again, right now we're at 33.6%. This chart is in the replies to this Spaces. And another interesting thing that we can see is leading out of the tech bubble, the earnings contribution of the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 was about 27%. Out of 08, it was about 32%. At the peak prior to COVID, it was 33%. That was when we peaked late 21. And now, even though the top 10 stocks make up 33.6% of the S&P 500, their earnings contribution is only 23.5%. Now, what we also are seeing is on a forward PE basis, right now, the forward PE of the S&P 500 is 20.4x. We saw a prior peak at the last market peak of late 21 of 21.4x. Prior to that, the peak in 2020, right before the COVID crash, was 19.2x. Prior to that, the peak going into 08 was 15.1. The peak going into the tech bubble, the beginning of the trough, was 25.2x. It shows pretty clearly that we're at the top of what looks to be an incoming trough. And interestingly enough, you know, the VIX is very low. Buying protection on long positions is pretty cheap right now, especially given the 1,100 to 1,200 point rally we've just had. It seems like a no-brainer to, at least if you want to stay long, to buy protection, or I don't want to say to start getting short, but it might be time to start looking to play the.
I'm going to offer my 2 cents on this. As I told everyone last week who listened to our little test broadcast where we tried to figure out spaces and how it functioned, this is kiddie week. The serious adults are out of the country. They're in St. Bart's. They're in Florida. They're in the BVI, which is where I should be. They are not spending their money in the markets right now. It's managed. They're hedged. They're saying the hell with it. They're not going to make any major moves. We have a 2 week period of quiet also. Until Passover is over with, you will not see a major market move up or down, in my opinion. So by mid-April, it should occur. And to indulge everyone, I'd like to invite Coastal in if he wants to speak. And also we've got Bear and Jason standing by. Guys, whoever wishes to speak first, please pipe in. Okay. Yep. Another request here. Let me get them in there.
All right. I guess I'll take you up on it. I wanted to backpedal a little bit to the earlier part of the conversation when you guys were talking about the gig economy, and you kind of also went into housing. And, you know, you were just talking about hyperinflation or getting into a deflationary period. You know, we have to pick one, or it's going to go on its own in one. I cannot recall who it is, but there's a lady I follow who regularly is putting up data on short-term rental markets, you know, Vrbo and whatnot. And you guys have probably read about all the backlash that's going on in that industry. HOAs are coming after them. Insurance companies are saying they're not going to cover these short-term rental properties. It's a big backlash, but I think that market was one of the primary drivers of this big run-up in house prices once the COVID lockdowns hit. You know, everybody thought the world was going to end, and, you know, they started shuttering lumber mills. And but what happened was when all of this direct in-the-mailbox stimulus went out and people, you know, were able to work from home and they took interest rates back down to zero, I think that was really what fueled it, because now people had a little extra spending cash. People could work outside of the office, so people were taking vacations, and that short-term rental market just exploded. So people were buying with that stimulus and those low interest rates. They were buying multiple properties, accumulating, and, you know, hey, boy, I'm going to do this forever. This is going to pay these properties off, and 20, 30 years down the line, I'm going to have this big, you know, real estate portfolio. Well, now that all of that's changing, I think imminently we're going to probably start seeing a lot of distressed properties, at least from what I'm reading on this lady's output, start hitting the market. At the same time, we've got all the new construction out there. So I think you're going to see a lot more house deflation coming up, you know. So I think that, you know, I lean more towards we're going to go into a more deflationary period unless the government somehow wants to send direct stimulus out to people. I mean, inflation's eating everybody alive. So anyway, wondering if anybody had any thoughts on that.
Jason, thank you very much. And I'm going to go ahead and bring in Bear, who is standing by. I appreciate you coming back on there, Bear. Please put your two cents in.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I find it pretty interesting all around some of the comments, all really well articulated. You know, one thing that I've been in Silicon Valley the last 13 years of my life and working in the startup realm. And made a pivot over to the energy side. And I'm actually seeing a lot of jobs in New York and California shift to the Midwest. And a lot of my network that has been in the Bay Area and Los Angeles and New York, I'm seeing a lot of, and this is my own anecdotal experience. So, you know, it doesn't have a macro chart behind it, but I'm seeing a big shift to that Midwest, Tennessee, Ohio Valley region. And kind of more centralized, you know, people are kind of shifting towards those economic valleys just because on the coastal cities, you're seeing so much immigration come in where there's a big impact on, you know, the L.A. metro region right now. And I'm seeing it every day just over in my neck of the woods in Santa Monica. It's really interesting to hear some of these thoughts. You know, one thing I found really interesting, you know, around the first Q1 of this year is, you know, it's no, you know, when you've been in the markets for 20 years, you can kind of see these extensive rallies after those. You know, we had a 50% correction, a 30% correction, and then, you know, two 15% corrections all within 3.5 years of each other. So a big rally off the lows off of October and chasing the year end to catch that Q1 momentum isn't something, you know, out of the ordinary. But I found it really odd how there's this weak moment in the market, you know, post Jan and Feb OPEX heading into that Q1 window. And it's almost like we just skated on it like ice and it was like Jesus walking on water. So, you know, it's really interesting to see how little weakness there was in those really what I would consider dangerous periods with all of the structured products that are sitting in those quarterly OPEXs like March, right? You have a lot of tinder that can light up the fire there. And we kind of just scathed right through it. And this is actually the first time, I don't know if anyone knows this, but in history where you've been up, you know, 30% off the lows and you didn't correct more than 2.5% into Q1 and coming out of March OPEX. So this is the first time, I mean, this has been the strongest rally in history relative to, there's only been 7 other correlations in history. And 2 of those 7 have actually aligned in a Q1 rally. And both of those other 2 rallies actually that were in correlation, I think one was 1962 and the other one was 1984. Both of those other years, I'd have to double check on them, but they corrected in Jan and then also coming out of March OPEX. So, and we skated right through that. It's, you know, the intensity of this rally, I feel like, has a lot more momentum. And I feel like the Treasury and the political initiatives, you know, want markets at all-time highs come year end. So I don't think it's a bad idea to, you know, have some hedges out there into year end if you wanted to keep playing this rally. I mean, volatility is bound to pick up into the election as it does every single election cycle. So I think the resolve of that will be really interesting to see how that plays out.
Bear, I appreciate your input. You're making me feel old, man, because my bones go all the way back to the late 70s when I was in high school, then college. And one of the things I noticed is that everyone seems to think that the Volcker problems or comparisons to Powell have disappeared. But everyone forgets that in 1980, in May, June, and July, Paul Volcker cut rates heading into an election year. And it was for political favor and currying to Jimmy Carter. Unbeknownst to him, Ronald Reagan would win the election in a landslide, And there was a backlash against the Fed, not like we have now with the social media backlash and the mainstream financial media backlash, but from a private perspective, there was. I think what we're going to see next is a cut, and I stand by a prediction that I've made with my MacroWedge teammates, that we're going to see 50 basis points in June, 25 in July. There's your three cuts rolled into two nice quick cuts to bring the Fed funds rate in line with the 10-year and leave it alone till after the election. But by then, the damage will be done, and December is going to be a nightmare for whoever wins the election.
Do you think, too, like you talked about the social media part, that they're just, since everybody's watching, it's kind of like how the whole CRE's been extending pretend. Everything's been, if the rules don't work, change the rules. You know, is it just getting to the point where everybody's watching? And like I always say, the biggest thing that we're supporting in this society is failure. And so since everybody's watching, we want everything to be great because nothing.
Absolutely. And I think people are absolutely freaking out over what's happening. And I honestly believe that this is going to end poorly for the economy in the end.
Yeah, I would second that notion, right? I think there's, you know, they're choosing growth over inflation, and that never ends well long term. And I think I would agree with you. Whoever wins the election come year end is going to have a really big decision to make relative to how they, you know, piecemeal markets back together, because it's going to be very fragile when you're sitting somewhere north of 5,500, maybe 6,000 at year end if you choose growth over inflation and let things run really hot, right?
Absolutely. And Six, please go ahead and jump in on this, but I want to throw this out here for everybody to consider. When was the last time we saw gold, the CRB index, cocoa, and all of these commodities at all-time highs, yet we're told we're in a disinflationary environment? Bueller, anybody? I'm open to hearing this.
Yeah, I think it's pretty evident that the inflation basket is running, because the market anticipates that Fed is complacent on letting inflation run above trend. On the flip side of that, to be fair, I don't think Powell honestly has done that bad of a job. He did the entire time. He basically did what he said he was going to do. Just to play devil's advocate here, he did what he said he was going to do. And he hasn't cut rates, and he hasn't said he's about to cut rates. He very clearly wants to cut rates, but he hasn't yet. I'm not sure that tapering the balance sheet runoff is the right move here, but it seems like he's done, you know, it's a hard position he's in as the Fed chair, because if he does too much, we're very obviously going to plunge into a recession because of the enormous debt burden and all that. I think he's in a tricky, really tricky position, just to play the devil's advocate and look at it from his perspective. On the equities rally right now, something that I noticed that I think is important is that on November 7th of last year, right at the beginning of this monster rally we just saw with basically no pullback, commodity trading advisors were short their largest leverage short position in over 5 years. They obviously got that dead wrong. CTAs as a whole tend to get it dead wrong. Right now, they are very, very long. So that gives me pause about the rally continuing to the upside, at least in the equity indices. In terms of commodities like oil, I'm bullish oil right now. Right now we saw on crude oil futures, we saw late February resistance was put in around 81. Now that resistance has turned into support. Thursday, the last day that markets were open. We put in a new year-to-date high. It looks like that's not going to slow down. So the commodity basket looks like it's definitely going to go higher. And, yeah.
No disagreement, Bear. I'm not going to disagree with you at all. I think that we have a commodity run until August, September of this year. And I think that despite the pending sell and may go away correction, which I view as something that's about to happen, once that is over with, commodities have room to run until the election, and then God knows what's going to happen. They're going to have a lot of issues. Six, I'd like to get your input on this, because otherwise I'm going to talk about BNPL to close the program out.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you until there's a substantial change in inflation expectations and inflation numbers as a whole. It looks like, you know, the whole inflation basket, gold, oil, commodities in general, is going to run. It looks like China might be, I mean, I'm pretty bullish on China right now. The 15,000 level on the Hang Seng Index is something that was defended by the CCP late 2022. And again, recently, it just came out this week from a leaked document from October that was just finally made public this week, that China was talking about making their central bank buy their bonds again, which would be extremely bullish for China. I mean, their Hang Seng Index is at a level that it was last at 12 years ago. It looks like there's a fantastic floor opportunity at 15,000 on the Hang Seng. Right now it's at 16,500. I don't think you have a whole lot of downside risk here. I mean, if it breaches 15,000 to the downside, I'd want to be out. But, I mean, you're looking at, especially if they start buying bonds, you're looking at maybe 50% gains on a basket of tech stocks if you can hold on to it.
Absolutely. Folks, I'd like to sit there and invite anybody else that wishes to add to the commentary. We try to keep this nice and tight to an hour. We knew this could become an issue with the volume of individuals tuning in to hear just what we have to say. If anybody else would like to speak up, just ask. Otherwise, I'm going to say one thing that I think is important. If we thought the economy was stable and sound, we would not see advertisements in grocery stores and at Starbucks and airports for buy now, pay later. One of my favorite posters and signs was for a Starbucks actually promoting a $6.50 schedule, latte, coffee, whatever, and you could finance it in four payments of $1.625 per payment for 4 months with zero interest. Gang, a healthy economy does not need to promote BNPL credit as an offering to promote economic viability. And that's where I think the flaw is going to come in and bite everyone in the proverbial arse and crash the system at some point if we do not allow a deflationary correction.
Just a quick question. Who is extending the credit? Is it the individual companies? Like, is Starbucks the one that's on the line extending that credit, or are they working with third parties?
The credit is extended through finance companies. There's a dark pool out there. Most of the credit is still being extended by Visa, MasterCard, and the various banks. But if you look into it further, a prime example of what happened today, dumping it back on the taxpayers, they reclassified bonds issued for repairs on utilities as asset-backed securities instead of corporate bonds. That caused a higher interest rate to be incurred by utilities nationwide. Hell, we know all about that in Florida, and gave justification for rate increases, whether it's for blizzards, fires, earthquakes, or in our case, hurricanes. You look at the financial chicanery going on and the machinery that is happening in behind the scenes, you can see how this, from the macro level down to the local level, becomes a problem
for the consumer and eventually for those that are investing in asset-backed securities. It eventually blows up in their face. And we got Nick G joining us real quick. Hang on, guys. I want to go ahead and prove him into the conversation, and then we're going to start wrapping this up so we can clean it up and get everybody to bed since some of us have been up since 4 a.m. Nick, bring it on board, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me up. I just wanted to add to, you know, what you were just saying. Who's been selling gold bars recently that hasn't in the past, right? I mean, most of you probably know the answer to that question, but shit. You know, I know Costco's doing it, right? But who else is? There's a bunch of other characters out there doing it, right? A lot of retailers. So I don't know. That tells me the temperature, right? I mean, you don't have to. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to kind of tell you what the temperature is out there. But, you know, something's brewing, right? Even so, the average Joe with his head down, right, working, not being able to pay attention to this, not part of FinTwit or X, whatever the shit is now, can still kind of rationalize, like, oh, yeah, something's going. I'm paying, like, crazy amounts of money for groceries, and Costco's selling gold bars to me now. So, like, thumbs up.
There you go. I'm going to invite Mark in here. Mark, please close it out, and then I'm going to go ahead and give a quick ad and commentary so we can wrap this up tonight. Mark, do you have anything else you wish to add to this?
Yeah. Like, my two cents is actually I was looking at the commodities as well, and what I was contemplating on that, if you look at the aspects and everything else, like, what are they going to build the data centers and the chips, right? So they are going to, there will be the need for copper and any other materials what they have to make the chip. They could be silver as well in some ways, but any other materials like steel as well to build up the data centers. And like, so my point is that when AI stocks will have the Minsky moment, right, when their earnings will start to decrease, then everything else, like commodity-wise, it will start to increase. And on the other hand, like, if you think about the Russian and Ukraine war, like, from what are you going to build up Ukraine? So again, commodities. And another factor what I want to talk about, it's everything is shifting like towards protectionism. So governments start to build up their onshore production, their onshore mining. So they are shifting away from the open global, from the open global trade supply chain and everything, which is again like inflationary. Because when you open up the supply chain and you want to make efficient supply chain, reduce prices, it's deflationary. And like, like my point is that everything goes towards inflationary, in my opinion. And on the other hand, if you look at the nominal GDP as well, that's like, it's like the highest ever been. And all of the money which has been put by fiscal stimulus, monetary stimulus, they have to go somewhere. So where the money is going to go, right? Like, follow the money. And we will see what will happen, but I think these AI stock will have their Minsky moment, and they will have like supply chain issues, which will put us back to commodities. And I would say that in the future, in the next 1-2 years, we will see like 3.5% inflation with a lower rate of interest rate, because you have to inflate the national debt as well somehow, right? So what are you going to do with that lot of debt what the nations accumulated? And U.S., actually, it's in a quite good position compared to any other countries because that's the dominant currency. So they can do whatever they want.
Thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate it. Folks, we're going to have to wrap this up because it's past our bedtime, or some of us' bedtime. I want to thank all of our listeners, all of our speakers, and for everybody tolerating me. throughout this program. It was our first effort. It'll get better. It'll get smoother. And we will have more invites for listeners to participate. We're going to probably do a residential real estate special. We understand this is a holiday, and we have some fantastic writers and commentators at MacroEdge.net. If you're not subscribed to MacroEdge.net via Substack, if you're not a subscriber to the upcoming Ozone special feature with data, real data, hard data, not your bubble vision data that you see in a flash and everyone justifies, then you should go to MacroEdge.net, investigate what is being offered, and pay attention to the commentary. I'm not the smart, sharpest knife in that drawer. There are a lot of great commentators and writers there. But as a historian and someone somewhat opinionated on the subject of the economy, trust me, it's worth your time and your money. For MacroEdge.net, this is John Galt speaking. Good night, everyone.